This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Growing numbers of Central American migrants arriving at the border. It is the U.S.-Mexico border, but many say this is a hemispheric problem.
Until we address those root causes together, we can expect to see this year in and year out, just as we have for decades.
Migrants are fleeing poverty, crime, and hunger, and hurricanes. If there's another bad storm season,
the situation is even going to be worse, and more people are going to find other ways to survive.
And surviving means more migration. Also today, Israeli voters once again schlep to the polls. Again, it's all about Bibi Netanyahu and whether Israelis want to build a more democratic country. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to be with you today. We start this week at the U.S.-Mexico border, where migrants are continuing to arrive in large numbers, with many more expected in the days ahead. The Biden administration is taking a lot of heat from many sides for not being adequately prepared. The new secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, made the rounds this weekend trying to reassure everybody that things are under control. Here he is on CNN.
We are working around the clock 24/7. Let me share with you that this is what we do. We know how to do it. We have dealt with surges in the past, and the men and women of the Department of Homeland Security will succeed.
So what exactly is happening at the border, and how does this moment compare with other times when there's been a sharp uptick in migration? Here to break it down for us is The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. Monica, we're hearing that the number of migrant families apprehended at the border is rising, but also that the vast majority of people arriving at the border are being turned back. So help us understand what's going on here.
We are seeing a clear rise in migrants at the border. Those who are allowed in include children who come alone and parents with young children. Everybody else mostly is sent back across the border in the name of COVID-19 restrictions. And it's hard to know how many people in total are approaching because the numbers also reflect single men who have attempted to cross perhaps multiple times. But it's clear that there are more kids under the age of 18 arriving alone, and there's pressure to move them out of Border Patrol holding cells, which migrants often call ice boxes because they're freezing cold, and children are being held in these places for longer times than they're supposed to.
There were a lot of warnings that this rise in migration was going to happen as soon as Biden lifted certain Trump-era restrictions. The White House is being criticized for being unprepared. Is that assessment accurate? I mean, what could be overlooked here in that assessment?
I mean, Biden officials themselves say that they did anticipate this increase. The Biden administration argues that they had no help from the Trump administration during the transition. Clearly, this was a transition between presidencies that was like no other. Could have been different if there were more help. However, questions persist whether there could have been more of a plan in place. Why are we seeing FEMA enlisted just recently after many weeks, you know, since the administration took office? What is clear is that we're seeing once again a cycle of migration, including with kids, and a lack of infrastructure at the border to accommodate them.
So what has the Biden administration put in motion to try and address the larger number of migrants approaching the border, especially all these kids?
We are seeing makeshift influx centers once again open near the border to house many of these children, thousands. Hotel rooms are also being contracted out. One challenge is COVID. Other shelters in other parts of the country are available, but bed space is limited because of restrictions due to the virus. There's also growing pressure, especially from advocates, for the Biden administration to send more of its people to the border, meet straight with the kids and ask them, do you have a phone number to call in your pocket, perhaps, that somebody is waiting for them in the United States? They don't need to linger in a crowded space. They can go straight to their family's home.
So we saw a new holding center for kids open up, which suggests that the numbers are only increasing and will continue to do so. What are you watching out for next, Monica?
The story is not going away anytime soon. I mean, we can expect that the numbers may rise, particularly as the weather gets better. You know, migration is cyclical, and this is a time when we usually see more people approaching the U.S.-Mexico border. The conditions in Central America are not getting any better. I'm particularly watching out for the improvement on the U.S. economy as jobs and people kind of roar back to business and people start going out to restaurants, and you will have people in Central America look to the United States and see work where they are not seeing work in their country of Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, for example. I'm also interested in Biden's regional approach. He's investing, he says, more in Central America to try and shore up conditions there so people won't have to leave their home. And that's an effort supported by some members of Congress, including Representative Veronica Escobar, who is in El Paso, Texas.
Until we address those root causes together with Central America, with Mexico, and with Canada, until we work together as a hemisphere, again, we can expect to see this year in and year out, just as we have for decades.
And one question, Marco, is whether these attempts will be different than previous efforts. Will it take a generation to see changes in parts of Central America? Well, we have the immediate challenge of people not always able to wait and deciding to leave their homes now.
The World's Immigration Editor, Monica Campbell, getting us started today. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The past year has been especially rough for Central America. Countries there have been hit by the pandemic, of course, but also hurricanes and growing hunger. According to the World Food Program, nearly 8 million people in Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua are experiencing hunger this year, which has led to even more people trying to leave. Miguel Barreto is a regional director of the World Food Program for Latin America and the Caribbean. He joins me from Panama. The number of people facing hunger, Miguel, in Central American countries has almost quadrupled, I see, in the last 2 years. What do you see behind this increase?
You are reading and listening to stories of migrants at the U.S. border. What probably you don't hear enough is what these people in need are going through in their countries. And the situation in Central America, as you well mentioned, has deteriorated further during the 2020. The numbers of people in hunger has increased from 2.2 million to 8 million, mostly due to the COVID and, of course, the lockdowns. But this is also related to previous drought situation, particularly in the dry corridor crossing over the whole Central American region. And as you mentioned, that the figure of people in hunger has skyrocketed. But among the 8 million in hunger now, according to our surveys, 1.7 million are in an emergency category of food insecurity and require urgent food assistance for survival. We need, as WFP, $47 million just to assist these people during the incoming 6 months in Central America.
We're looking at countries in Central America, though, that have fertile lands. They export a lot of crops. So help us understand how a country that can export food also struggles to feed its own people.
In some way, it's because most of these poor people are dependent basically on two crops, which is maize and beans. And most of them are basically survival agricultural procedures. So they are not necessarily engaged in the big economy and are able to receive the incomes that they inherit or they merit because of this type of exportation models. So you have to understand that the main problem in Latin America at all, and of course in Central America, is inequality in the income. So the income is not really distributed fairly among all the population, and that's why we still having a lot of poor in the region. And the problem for them is not just the income, but also the access to good social services that allow them to have a better life.
Miguel, you've been to some of the areas hardest hit by hurricanes, Eta and Iota in Honduras and Nicaragua last year. What did you see and how all of this kind of ties back into hunger?
Yes, effectively, I was traveling through Honduras, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. And the situation is, of course, very bad for them because the hurricanes, two hurricanes, Category 5, hit the country one week after the other. The communities that I visit, I basically check their testimonies in the sense that they lost everything. And of course, the capacity to recover is not a short-term capacity. Even if government are trying to support, they don't have the right capacity to reach all these people in need. And one of the problems that we are facing, and they are facing also, is that the crop production is going to be affected because the next harvest season in Central America is in August. So the lean season normally is between May and June. Now with the hitting of the hurricanes, their capacity to get income has deteriorated. But in addition to that, coffee crops also were affected. And most of these poor people also migrate internally, okay, for temporary income. And now because of this situation, they don't have the capacity to migrate and get some money with this temporary work.
So Miguel, the pandemic isn't over yet. More storms will undoubtedly come this summer. Are you expecting things to get worse before they improve?
We hope no, but the new cyclonic season this year starts probably in June. And the forecast is that it's going to be as hard as last year. So we cannot avoid the fact that probably these areas are going to be affected again. But of course, this is a cyclonic season that is covering the whole Caribbean area, including Central America. But what I can say is that if this happens, the situation is even worse and more people are going to find other ways to survive, among them to migrate to other places, to cities or even north.
Miguel Barreto speaking with us about the hunger crisis in Central America. He's the regional director of the World Food Program for Latin America and the Caribbean. Miguel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you to you for your time.
For this next story, some bird songs are in order. Let me read a passage from the book that's largely credited with starting the environmental movement in the U.S., Rachel Carson's 1962 volume, Silent Spring. On the mornings that had once throbbed with the dawn chorus of robins, catbirds, doves, jays, wrens, and scores of other bird voices, there was now no sound. In a time when the word dystopian is used probably too much, to think about a day when birds die out, that is truly dystopian. Rachel Carson's warning was warranted, though. Birds are vanishing. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports on one species that is forgetting how to sing.
Once upon a time in eastern Australia, regent honeyeaters roamed in huge flocks. But thanks to deforestation, today there are only 300 of the little guys left. And in 2015, ecologist Ross Crates and his team at Australian National University, Canberra, set out to find them using speakers.
So what we do is we spend 5 minutes in a spot where we think the habitat is suitable for regent honeyeaters, and we play the song of regent honeyeater.
Here's the idea. If the birds are breeding in that area, they'll become really aggressive.
They'll hear the song and they'll think that another male is trying to intrude on their territory. And then they'll fly in and shout around and make themselves much more easy for us to find.
That happened. But also,
we noted that some of the males were singing these weird songs.
Just like humans learning to speak, birds learn to sing when they're babies. They do it by listening to and then repeating the sounds of older males. But when there aren't any older honey eaters around, they'll learn from whoever is around, like friar birds, wattle birds, or the delightfully named cuckoo shrikes. So this is a regent honey eater. But so is this. And this. Ecologist Ross Crates said it blew his mind.
I just thought it was absolutely fascinating. I guess I didn't realize at the time the kind of implications it was going to have once we started looking at this further.
Turns out female honey eaters don't like to mate with males who sing strange songs. Crates says taking on the language of another species might be leading the honey eater closer to extinction.
The analogy would be with humans. If you weren't able to hang around with other humans as a child, you wouldn't be able to communicate properly. And if you can't communicate properly, that's going to impact on your ability to survive and find a partner and all sorts of other ways.
So what if the birds got a language tutor? There's a captive breeding program where male regent honey eaters are raised in captivity and then released into the wild. Now, while the baby males are in captivity, researchers are playing them audio recordings of the correct song. So once they're released, they'll be attractive to the wild females, pointing to an age-old truth. There's nothing sexier than guys who can sing. Let's get it on. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum. Let's get it on. Let's love,
baby. Let's get it on. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Could there at last be peace in Yemen? Today, Saudi Arabia announced that it was seeking to end Yemen's six-year civil war. The Saudis have supported Yemen's government in its conflict with Houthi rebels. The toll of that war has been grim. It's estimated that more than 100,000 people have been killed and around 4 million people displaced. Abu Bakr al-Shamahi has been following this. He's a researcher with the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies and is speaking with us from Raleigh, North Carolina. How significant is this latest development, Abu Bakr? Does it mark an actual change of policy for Saudi Arabia and Yemen?
Well, this isn't the first time that the Saudis have announced a ceasefire plan, almost this time last year, I think, with the start of the coronavirus pandemic spreading around the region. They announced a ceasefire plan then, and nothing really happened at the time. Now, this time, the Saudis do appear to be attempting to make a big deal out of this, so to speak. What they're saying is if the Houthis agree on the other side and the Yemeni government agree as well, that there will be, you know, an end to the war in the country, a ceasefire. The Sana'a airport, which is the main airport in the country controlled by the Houthis, will reopen, a number of other things as well. So all very good things. But you have to remember that this comes on the sixth anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi intervention in Yemen. Saudi normally gets a lot of heat at that time in the international arena from the international press. And they'll be attempting to make out, especially to the new U.S. administration, that they are willing to make peace with the other side. Now, what remains to be seen is what the response from the other side is going to be. We've already heard from spokesmen from the Houthis, for example, saying that this is nothing new, that this deal, this proposal brings nothing new. And so based on that, it's still really early days, and we're going to have to see whether this will actually lead to an end to even this latest bout of fighting in the country.
So one thing you just said, the new U.S. administration, it is different. What does it mean that this announcement from Saudi Arabia came after the U.S. announced that it was no longer supporting Saudi's offensive operations in the war?
Now, the U.S., the Biden administration, knows that it can't really force the Saudis to stop. But just by symbolically almost ending support for Saudi offensive operations in Yemen, Biden has really indicated that he wants some kind of change from the Saudi side. Now, in terms of this proposal, I think, yes, it is important that it's come after the beginning of the new U.S. administration. But like I say, I think it might be more of an attempt to get support from the Biden administration and show that, yes, we are doing something, without that actually necessarily translating to real action on the ground.
So what do you think this actually means for the war on the ground? How likely is fighting to continue after this announcement?
I think fighting will continue. The proposal is a proposal. You know, it's not an actual change to the Saudis' actions on the ground or the other forces in the conflict. The Saudis are saying themselves, nothing changes until we get agreement from all sides on this.
And as we consider the Yemeni people, how immediately do you think this news will lead to an easing of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen?
Now, unfortunately, all sides are very realistic about this, almost realists, and they all see that these humanitarian issues are directly related to political and military issues. And all of that just means, really, that, as you said, on the ground, civilians are the ones who are suffering. It's almost around three quarters of the country, of the Yemeni population, who are in need of aid. And that situation is only getting worse.
Abu Bakr al-Shamahi is a researcher with the Sana'a Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with us from Raleigh, North Carolina, about the news from Saudi Arabia that the kingdom is looking to establish a ceasefire in the Yemen war. Abu Bakr, thank you.
Thank you.
Once again in Israel, it's off to the races.
מדינת ישראל שוב תלך לבחירות בפעם הרביעית בתוך פחות משנתיים.
Tomorrow, Israelis go to the polls, the fourth national election in Israel in just 2 years. So what is different this time around? The world's Ariel Osseran is on the line from Tel Aviv. Hey, Ariel.
Hey, Marco.
So, Ariel, what is the big political story here ahead of the vote Tuesday?
So the big political story here is that Israelis are tired. I mean, they voted already 3 times in the past 2 years, and they have to go to the ballots again. You have Israel's longest sitting prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. He wants to be reelected again. And this is pretty much a contest between him, his supporters, and those who would finally like to see him end his tenure as prime minister and leave office. I will say, though, that we're so used to continuous rounds of election that more than previous rounds, Israelis are now pretty much gearing up for the 5th round.
Wow.
The majority of Israelis think that this election won't bring a decisive outcome.
All right, we're not there yet. We're still on election number 4, and it's still all about Benjamin Netanyahu. Remind us why there is this 4th election in 2 years.
So, first of all, it's important to understand how elections work here. And, you know, Israelis, when they go to vote, they don't pick a certain politician. Instead, they vote for a party. Israelis have become more polarized in recent years, so there isn't one party or one leader that can win an outright majority. It's about building a coalition, partnerships of parties of at least 61 seats.
61.
Yeah, 61 out of 120. And recent polls show that neither big political bloc, either on the right or on the left, has that majority. I asked Professor Tamar Herman about this. She teaches political science at the Open University of Israel.
In a way, the fact that none of the two political blocs is able to get a clear-cut majority is a reflection of the fact that the Israeli public is divided almost in the middle.
Herman says that this is actually dangerous for Israel's democratic stability. Political division has led to this exhausting stalemate, she says, and it's really hurt the country, especially during this pandemic.
So if we're looking for a way out of this division, I mean, these main blocks you're talking about, right and left, is that the same as supporters of Netanyahu versus his political opponents, or is it even more complex than that?
Well, the simple answer is yes and no. The complex answer is that Netanyahu does hope to form a right-wing coalition headed by his conservative Likud party, and with parties he refers to as his natural allies. These are the ultra-Orthodox and religious Zionist parties. But this time he doesn't really have one main contender. The opposite bloc isn't united ideologically, and they're simply hoping to defeat Netanyahu, but they're having a really difficult time joining forces and cooperating against him coherently. As you pointed out, though, many Israelis do see this as a referendum over Netanyahu's continued reign. You're either pro-Bibi, that's Netanyahu's nickname, or anti-Bibi. But it's even more than that. Here's Professor Herman again.
The very external layer is for or against Netanyahu, but basically Netanyahu stands for something. And this something is a Jewish state, with more concern about its Jewishness rather than its democratic nature.
Herman goes on to point out that until recently, the political divide in Israel used to be mainly around the conflict with the Palestinians. Today, it's actually more similar to the divide between Democrats and Republicans in the U.S.
The world's Ariel Osseran speaking from Tel Aviv about Israel's 4th national election in 2 years. That's coming up tomorrow. Ariel, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
More stories from around the globe still ahead. You're listening to The World. Marco Werman here. 1,098. That's how many people donated to The World during the fall fundraising campaign. Those 1,098 incredible people, maybe you're one of them, helped us surpass our goal of $100,000. And we want to thank some of you right now. Piamini Kamowit, Aaron Rachamadugu, Crystal Calhoun, Malcolm Phelps, Sharon Jaffe Dan, Carol Spencer, Jamie Wright, David English, Chelsea Isson, and Ahmed Khalif. Thank you. Also, thank you to all of our listeners. We could not have done it without you. In El Salvador, an environmental victory against foreign mining companies, a common threat united Salvadoran conservatives and progressives.
People were probably shooting at each other a decade earlier.
Also ahead, a hard pandemic year for Brazilians. We look back and ahead with Brazil's fight against COVID coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Safe and 79% effective. That is the word from AstraZeneca today about the U.S. study of its COVID-19 vaccine. This is the vaccine that a lot of the world will and is already relying upon to protect people from COVID, especially poorer countries in the U.N.'s COVAX program. But AstraZeneca's had a rough ride with European regulators approving, then pausing, then restarting the vaccine. The long-awaited U.S. data was hoped to boost public confidence. Dr. Miguel Nicolelis has been following these developments closely. He joins us from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Doctor, more than 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine arrived in Sao Paulo yesterday. That's Brazil's first shipment from the COVAX program. How does it feel to have these vaccine doses ready to distribute right now?
Well, in Brazil, the acceptance of the vaccine has been pretty high. So people here are really eager to get vaccinated. So the news that this shipment had finally arrived in Brazil was very good news for most Brazilians and for most of the Brazilian press.
How much confidence do Brazilians have in the AstraZeneca vaccine, given kind of some of the doubts that were cast on it over the past few weeks?
Well, those doubts never materialized in Brazil. Brazil has a very stingy regulatory agency, Anvisa, that studied the data that AstraZeneca submitted to the regulators for several weeks, and it concluded that the vaccine was safe. And also, when the news from Europe came, Anvisa again supported the AstraZeneca vaccine, saying that the data from Europe showed that the thrombotic episodes were statistically not above what you see in a control population. So far in Brazil, the acceptance of the population has been pretty high.
So how is Brazil doing overall today, Monday, the 22nd of March, with COVID? And what kind of a difference does this arrival of AstraZeneca vaccines make, do you think?
Well, Brazil is doing very poorly. We are in a very dramatic situation right now. I just saw the numbers from last week was the most deadly week in Brazil since the beginning of the pandemic. And we had more deaths that week than twice the number of deaths in the U.S. So it's a very dramatic and critical situation. And Brazil is vaccinating just about 300,000 people a day, which is 7 to 10 times less than it should be doing right now. The expectation was 2 to 3 million doses a day, pretty close to what the U.S. is doing, because, you know, Brazil has the infrastructure and is used to vaccinate that many people a day in previous campaigns. So the country is doing very poorly, but the arrival of the shipment was extremely well received, because now Brazil needs tens of millions of doses to be able to vaccinate a large number, a large percentage of the population as soon as possible, because there is a tremendous problem given that the federal government is not imposing a national lockdown, is not contributing to the fight to COVID like most of us would like to see.
Dr. Nicolelis, we know that President Jair Bolsonaro is a COVID denier. I mean, that's got to have some impact on Brazil's current disastrous situation. But you also say people across Brazil have accepted the AstraZeneca vaccine. So when it comes to COVID, is Brazil divided across the country depending on one's personal politics?
The president of Brazil has been an extremely negative influence on the situation that we have here. Certainly, the small percentage of about 30 to 35% who supports him yet, because his numbers are going down like a stone because of his position denying the relevance and the tragic effects of the COVID pandemic, support him. But the vast majority of the population in Brazil is for a stronger fight for, you know, the pandemic down here. Most of the population at this point, is very obvious to anyone here, wants the vaccine and wants stronger measures to be taken. And now there is discussion of appealing to the Supreme Court so that the Supreme Court justices can take a position that would oblige the president of Brazil to either be removed from controlling the situation or change very drastically his position about the national lockdown and other measures, stronger measures that need to be taken together with the improvement of the rollout of the vaccination campaign. So, yes, there are people who still support the president, but they are at this point in the minority down here.
Dr. Miguel Nicolelis speaking with us from Sao Paulo, Brazil. Thanks very much for being with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
A year ago, last week, Brazil recorded its first death from COVID-19. Now more than 2,000 people there are dying each day from it. Between a slow vaccine rollout and a highly contagious Amazon variant, Brazil is seeing very little light at the end of the tunnel. Reporter Michael Fox looks back at the dire situation Brazilians have confronted over the past 12 months.
Last year, at this time, I was reporting in the Amazon and had to cut my trip short. Coronavirus was spreading. Brazil began closing its borders, suspending interstate travel, and issuing tight social restrictions. I bought a flight home to southern Brazil. Belém's Valdecans International Airport was moderately busy. Flights were canceled. People waited in lines to change tickets. Just past security, heading to my gate, I met Cleide Lima. She was in a gray t-shirt and wearing a white surgical face mask. She was stretched out across a row of seats next to her adolescent daughter and her husband. They had left their home in Manaus several days before to celebrate their 20th wedding anniversary in a Rio de Janeiro resort town. But when they arrived, everything was closed, and they had to be rerouted across four states to try to get back home. That'll be my memory of my 20th wedding anniversary, Cleide told me at the time. No beach celebration, lying on the airport floor, waiting for my connections. I thought about Cleide over the last year as Manaus suffered two deadly spikes of COVID-19. The latest in January came as oxygen ran out in hospitals across the city, and the images of mass COVID-19 graves again made headlines. So I called her to see how she was doing.
Oi. Oi, Cleide.
A lot of people that I know died, she said. I was terrified to open Facebook because I was constantly receiving messages that this or that friend had died. She said no one in her family had been infected because they've led a very restricted life. She said, I don't receive visitors. I only go out in extreme cases. My husband only goes out to work, and we avoid a social life. But I've become depressed and have anxiety. That's a reality for growing numbers of people across Brazil. According to a recent University of São Paulo study, Brazil leads the world with the highest percentage of its population with anxiety and depression under the pandemic. Back last year on my flight home, I had a layover in Belo Horizonte. The departure hall was busy. Some people wore masks, most didn't. They were hard to find. Pharmacies had run out weeks before. I met Aurenice Jacobi, sitting along a row of empty blue and white chairs. She's a 64-year-old grandmother who was returning to her home in Rio de Janeiro. At the time, it was one of the epicenters of the virus in Brazil. She told me, I'm a little scared with this coronavirus problem. We see a lot of people with masks, and that's a little scary. But I'm confident that this will soon pass. I recently called her too and asked her if she could have imagined that the pandemic could have lasted this long. No, at no point did I imagine that, she told me. We said, oh, this could last for 6 months, and then it just kept going, just more of the same. She said that her family has done its best to also remain isolated. She's retired, so she's been watching her grandson. She said they were blessed that no one in her family had died. She blames President Jair Bolsonaro for mishandling the pandemic. She said, he took a long time to do anything. He was against the vaccines. He was a bad example, bringing crowds together. He didn't use a mask. I thought this was very bad. That's the opinion of more than 60% of the country, according to a recent poll. Less than 20% of the population supports Bolsonaro's COVID-19 policies, but they have been vocal. In mid-March, Bolsonaro supporters held caravans in at least 9 cities in support of the president and against increased social restrictions, which are being implemented in many cities as COVID-19 cases rise around the country. Even Bolsonaro, it seems, has set out to change his image around the pandemic, as he's behind in early polls for next year's presidential elections.
Neste momento, convidamos o presidente da República.
At this event on March 10th, Bolsonaro signed a new law to help expedite the purchase of vaccines. He wore a mask in public for the first time in well over a month.
Fomos e somos incansáveis desde o primeiro.
He told the cameras, "We have worked tirelessly since the very beginning in the fight against the pandemic." He's now installing the country's fourth health minister in a year. Marcelo Queiroga is the president of Brazil's Cardiological Society.
A saúde está muito empenhado em trabalhar de maneira harmônica e em parceria.
That's him speaking to press about the vaccine rollout. The vaccine campaign is the big issue right now. Less than 2% of Brazil's population has been fully vaccinated. Bolsonaro's government says it's acquiring 500 million vaccines, but it's only purchased maybe a third of those so far, and the bulk won't be arriving for months. Meanwhile, the new highly contagious P1 Amazon COVID-19 variant is spreading rapidly across the country. In the months following my return home to Florianópolis last year, the city weathered the storm well with low numbers of cases and deaths. But today, hospitals are over capacity. There's a wait list to get into ICUs. The city has instituted overnight curfews. Health workers are demanding a full lockdown, but that seems unlikely to happen. Brazilians want this to be over, but the only thing on the horizon is uncertainty. For the world, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Our ongoing coverage of the coronavirus connects you to people and experts around the globe, all experiencing the pandemic in their own daily lives. Here's another way you can connect. Follow us on Twitter. Take some time to catch up with some stories you might have missed and meet the journalists who reported them. Our Twitter handle is very easy to remember. We are at The World. It may feel like it's been forever, but we're only about a year into dealing with COVID-19, and there's so much scientists still don't know about it. That's also true for viruses that have been around for decades, like Ebola. As The World's Ilana Gordon reports, scientists recently uncovered findings that are changing the way they understand how Ebola works.
In January of this year, a nurse in a rural part of the West African nation of Guinea died. After her burial, five of her family members and a traditional practitioner she had been in contact with all got really sick. Four of them died. Dr. Faali Magasuba says this was alarming.
Blood was taken from them and sent to our laboratory who detected the Ebola virus.
It was Ebola, something he and others had feared. Magasuba runs a national virus testing lab in Guinea.
So much worried because we remember what happened in 2014.
In 2014, a massive Ebola outbreak swept through West Africa. It made nearly 30,000 people sick and killed more than 10,000. This new outbreak in Guinea was discovered not too far from a center of that earlier one. The samples Magasuba reviewed this winter were the first positive cases of Ebola in 5 years. Guinea declared a new outbreak in February. Here's WHO's Africa Director, Matsidiso Moeti.
Our collective quick action is crucial to avert an uncontrolled spread of Ebola amid the COVID-19 pandemic, which has already pushed health workers and health facilities to the edge.
Investigators started doing Ebola contact tracing. Thousands of Ebola vaccines were sent to the region. But as that was happening, Magasuba and two other international teams got to work. They wanted to know, where did this outbreak come from? An animal? A human? Ahidu Ayuba is a self-described virus hunter based in France with the University of Montpellier and was part of the effort. He says step one was to sequence or map out the virus. And that's where they discovered something really surprising.
We found that it was very close to the strain that has caused the outbreak in Guinea 5 years ago.
Here's why this was weird. Viruses naturally mutate as they replicate and spread. But it turns out this new Ebola sample was nearly identical to the genetic makeup of a virus variant from 2016.
If there had been a transmission occurring at very low level, the virus should have changed even a little bit. But what we see is that it is just like no change. It is as if it was the same strain. The first thing we thought was that we had a lab contamination.
As in, did this specimen stored in a lab somehow get out by accident? Ayuba and others ruled that out fast because no labs were nearby. They also ruled out transmission from an animal because of certain characteristics they saw in the virus. Still, he and others couldn't believe what they were seeing. Another team repeated the sequencing and
same results as us.
It's as if the virus had been sleeping and woke up to infect another person. This possibility led to another question. Could the recent outbreak have been triggered by someone who had Ebola back in 2016 and then had a persistent or latent infection?
For whom, for some reasons, the virus restarted replicating and then to be transmissible.
The scientists recently posted their findings and raised this hypothesis. Dr. Nahid Bhatelia runs a special pathogens unit at Boston Medical Center. She was part of the Ebola response during the 2016 West Africa outbreak.
It is a big deal. It's something we've suspected for a while, but it's a big deal.
Bhatelia says it's been known for a long time that a very small portion of people who survive Ebola may still carry the virus after, but that it could potentially linger for this long a period of time is new. She says it's humbling to realize how much people in public health still don't know about Ebola. It speaks to a lack of investment and major gaps in healthcare systems. The virus was first identified in 1976.
The fact that we don't know more about it, the fact that we didn't know already that this could happen, that survivors could be affected by this disease for such a long period of time, that they could potentially be a source, an index case for a new cluster of cases, that's on us.
Researchers in Guinea are cautious about the preliminary findings, and they are deeply concerned about the impact they could have on people who have survived Ebola. A vast majority of survivors are not infectious, though in some cases it can spread through semen or breast milk. But this is a group that is highly stigmatized already. Frederic Lemarcy has been in the region interviewing people and is part of the research team.
It may be easily possible that survivors would be again targeted as the problem, the people with whom the problem comes. They may be chased out of their own communities.
Lemarcy says with this latest Ebola outbreak in Guinea, one thing above all needs to be clear. It's that survivors are not the problem. They are not the virus. But if the virus can come back after 5 years, that's a call for more support for communities impacted by Ebola. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
This is a story about gold and water and activism. El Salvador is dangerously close to running out of clean water. Its rivers were under threat from international mining companies for decades, companies that were after El Salvador's gold. But an unlikely alliance stopped them. People who were on opposite sides of the bitter civil war came together in 2017 to ban metal mining in El Salvador. The inside story is the subject of a new book, The Water Defenders. Robin Broad is the book's co-author. She joined me along with Luis Parada, the lawyer who fought the Pacific Rim Mining Corporation. Parada told me momentum for the ban began with the murder of one Salvadoran water defender.
Marcelo Rivera was the first activist that sounded the alarm about the danger of metallic mining in the province of Cabañas, where he was from. And he's the one that started educating all the other community members about this risk. First, he was disappeared, and nobody knew where he was until 2 weeks later when his body was found. The investigation that the government conducted supposedly led to finding the people who killed him, but didn't go beyond to find who may be behind the murders.
And Marcelo Rivera, how did his story capture the imaginations of Salvadorans across the political spectrum?
In a country like El Salvador, which is a very small country, 8,000 square miles, very densely populated, with risks of earthquakes, mudslides, and a water crisis that already was in place, he was the one that that actually led people to travel to Honduras to see the devastation of mining there, to another old mining site in El Salvador. And that's what made people start making other people aware of the risk of mining.
So, Robin, in the book you wrote with John Cavana, you chronicle the struggle of this group of Salvadoran activists known as the Water Defenders. These are not people with a lot of resources. Mining companies offered their towns jobs and money, but they were not interested. Why not?
Beginning with Marcelo, people very quickly came to understand that the jobs and the prosperity that they thought mining would bring were not the key thing that mining would bring. The key thing that mining was going to bring was that the mining companies used cyanide to separate the gold from the rock. That cyanide then gets into the water. El Salvador is a very small country, and El Salvador basically has one main river that supplies more than 50% of the water to the country. And for them, as for water defenders in many other countries, water is life. Water is more precious than gold. So a group of water defenders from all over the country came together in a coalition called La Mesa, the Roundtable Against Metallic Mining. These were ordinary people, but they were ordinary people who did extraordinary things. They proved to be amazing researchers. They studied hydrology, they studied geology, they studied mining. They took field trips across that one large river into Honduras, where they saw the impact of mining on the environment and on people's lives and also on their economies.
So these water defenders, they've reached out to all sorts of Salvadorans as well as forming international alliances. Luis, how is it that legislators from El Salvador's conservative Arena Party found common ground with former rebel leaders and Catholic church officials to ban mining?
Basically, they, like all the other political parties in El Salvador, became increasingly aware of the risks of mining. They became increasingly aware of where popular opinion was going towards mining. And in particular, it was very important that the member of the ARENA delegation in Congress, which was the largest party represented in Congress, attended one of the many workshops that the National Roundtable Against Metallic Mining organized. And he heard firsthand about the risks, about the use of cyanide, about how you had to go through several tons of rock to get to 1 gram of gold. And as the head of the ARENA delegation told me one day, it was this congressman, Johnny Wright, who convinced the ARENA party to ban metallic mining in El Salvador.
So it sounds like it was one lawmaker facing the facts on the ground. Robin, what do you think was key to bringing these former foes together?
First of all, the water defenders essentially knocked on the doors of unlikely allies. Most of those people didn't originally want to see the water defenders, but at a certain point they listened. We have a stereotype of activists. We think of them as just protesters. The water defenders of El Salvador were not simply protesting. They were doing it based on the science, and they weren't simply against mining. In fact, they get angry when you call them against mining. They called themselves pro-water. Their whole movement was for saving the water of El Salvador. That was part of what was effective.
So the book recounts two victories for environmental activists in El Salvador. One was getting the national legislature to pass that mining ban. The other was the lawsuit the mining company Pacific Rim launched against El Salvador's government, claiming it had been deprived of its right to start a gold mine. Luis, you helped win that case for El Salvador's government. How big a surprise was that victory?
Well, it was a very hard case. It took 7 years from beginning to end. And even when it ended with a victory for El Salvador, there was always the threat that Pacific Rim and its new owner, OceanaGold, were going to seek annulment of that award, starting another process that could last another 2 years. So yes, it was a welcome surprise.
So what do you think this experience says about how political change is happening in post-war El Salvador, Luis? I mean, it's a deeply polarized place, but are the usual alliances scrambled now when it comes to protecting the environment?
Well, I think this was a great case to show that when you are working for a common goal, in this case, protecting the environment, protecting water, there should not be any ideological barriers. So I think it shows that when people can focus on a common threat, they can work together past ideological differences they may have had in the past. And I think in the case of El Salvador, it was a very welcome change in mentality from the civil war that lasted 12 years. It's people that were working together to defend El Salvador now were probably shooting at each other a decade earlier. So that is great to see how people can come back to work together.
Luis Parada led El Salvador's defense team in a lawsuit against the Pacific Rim Mining Corporation. Robin Broad is the author, along with John Cavana, of The Water Defenders, How Ordinary People Saved a Country from Corporate Greed. Robin, Luis, thank you both so much.
Marco, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you tomorrow.